Hello, everyone. You are listening to Unsung Stories, Women at Columbia's Computer Music Center, a podcast series and one part of a three-pronged event on the history of composers of marginalized identities, including women composers of color who have worked in electronic and computer music at the CMC, and formerly the CPEMC, the Columbia-Princeton Electronic Music Center. I'm Skye McClay, and today I am in conversation with Sandra E. Woodruff II. Sandra is a professional recording artist, singer-songwriter, and guitarist. Sandra has toured with the Backstreet Boys in Germany, opened for Anthony Hamilton, performed with Taylor Swift, recorded a demo with LL Cool J, and played guitar for Aaron Pfeiffer, Drew Vision, Betts, and Grey's Anatomy star Sara Ramirez. Sandra has a bachelor's degree in music from Columbia, which is where she began to marry her love and practice of music with topics in cognitive neuroscience. Sandra has over 20 years of experience in the music industry as a performer and additional experience in tech, youth music program development, and performing arts production. As an artist consultant, Sandra supports artists by helping them shape and design their day-to-day and long-term career blueprints. Sandra and I met in the spring of 2017 at the CMC when she was in my electronic music class, and I was just wowed by her musicianship, her creativity, and her ability to record these big, rich, detailed, warm sounds. She was also a mentor with For the Daughters of Harlem, Working in Sound, which is a project inviting girls and young women of color from Columbia's, from New York City public high schools to Columbia and the CMC to make music. Today she's recording from Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for being here, Sandra.
Thank you so much, Skye. Thanks for having me.
So let's just get started here. As someone coming to Columbia and the CMC with an extensive background in the popular music industry, what was your experience like taking a class and working in a center which has traditionally focused on more academic and experimental music? How would you compare and contrast the culture and workflow of these two spheres?
That's a great question. I definitely spent probably a good 16 years in the pop world, you know, recording music and doing things mostly by ear. I mean, I've been playing music for a very long time. So to come into an academic way of practicing music was a very intentional choice when I was 36 to go back to school. And, you know, thinking about that sort of regimen was slightly different because the cognitive dissonance was me trying to match what I've been doing for so long and put it into this formulaic sort of paradigm. So even just basic music theory for me was something like, I know this sound, but I cannot match it with this. It doesn't make sense. There's a different way that I go about achieving, you know, a song, a melody, a pattern, which to say is, you know, you get the same result by doing it in a music theory way or looking at it in parsing frequencies and kind of like doing the math behind it and coming up with different tones. However, it was all internal, it was all in my ear. So that was a very different approach. And honestly, it was a slight struggle to think about, also just to be confident in what I've done in the last 16 years and to go to, you know, Columbia, an Ivy League, and this very academic setting where some of the language was very different, where I'm just, you know, play that note, play this note, you know, here's this, play that, and that's it. And now I have to actually match that with some sort of letter or pattern or rhythm. Was a very different culture, but in the end, post being in school, it actually shows up and makes more sense where I'm able to marry the two a lot more. So culture-wise, while I was in it, it was a slight struggle, but it was worth it. And the pop world was, that's what I was born in. You know, my family sings, they play. So from birth, we're just hearing and repeating and imitating. And that was the most interesting part, was how do I match that with some of the more structural academic ways of looking at music?
Yeah, I think that there are people sort of all over that spectrum at a place like Columbia, and we can all just really improve our skills by going further, learning by ear if you're not so good at that, and going further with written music if that's not your world. And I think, how about in can you say anything about electronic music specifically? Were there any sort of approaches in the recording studio or with electronic music that where the workflow was different at the CMC compared to recording studios where you've worked in the popular music industry?
Mm-hmm. I think thinking about the shapes of various sounds and thinking about MIDI in a very different way than I have thought before. Originally, I think, okay, so, you know, someone's saying they're playing MIDI, but I'm just thinking it's a piano sound. It's an analog sound. Even though it's MIDI, that's what it is. But looking at it in, you know, looking at it in Logic or looking at how you're changing, you know, some of the shapes of the waves that can, different sine waves or sort of like jigsaw type of waves. That was very different in thinking about how, you can change from an analog piano sound and really kind of cut up MIDI as opposed to, I just need something, I don't have a grand piano and I want to match this grand piano sound. So give me this sort of MIDI controllable. How far can I take that MIDI sound and kind of change it and reshape it? So that was something that I had never considered before, and also took for granted if someone did do it, because I wasn't doing it myself. I'm like, that's no longer a piano sound, but not really, you know, being able to really dissect what you can do with MIDI and how you can actually open up and change the sounds was definitely a new perspective for me coming into, especially your class, Guy, you know, looking in Intro to Digital Music. That was something that I learned. I was like, oh, I can break this apart and it becomes something completely different.
Oh, well, that's awesome. I'm so glad you took that away, because it was really special and cool to have such an advanced professional musician in my class. So I'm happy that you at least learned a few new things.
Yes.
So my next big question for you is coming to the music. I want to share a musical example of yours, which is a remix of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. And mm-hmm. This is a track that takes familiar guitar and vocal sounds and really sculpts them into beautiful objects that exist in distinct sonic spheres. For example, it begins in a really narrow, contained space, and then about 37 seconds in, it really opens up and encompasses the listener. And so can you tell us a little bit about your process for making this, and also what made you want to remix Smells Like Teen Spirit specifically?
Absolutely. So we were talking about playing with, you know, space and reverb and panning and some other frequencies. And with this being a project that, you know, like I said, working with MIDI and working with electronic music was something very new for me. I went to my roots, which is I'm a grunge kid, and I know Smells Like Teen Spirit like the back of my hand. I can play it the original way. I can play it, in a funky way. I've tried to play it in a salsa way, just on my guitar, but it seemed like it was the perfect song that I knew like the back of my hand, where I could kind of stay true to some of the melody, but how could I really, you know, change something that is, you know, guitars, drum, bass, very, very like, you know, acoustic sound, and kind of tear it apart, but also retain the melody where someone might be able to understand what it is. And for me, vocals are a big part of it for me. So playing with vocals in space was a really interesting thing. So just simply panning and trying to get people to, throw on some headphones and kind of follow my voice and be encapsulated in movement with my voice and placement and kind of being in the room, like, where is she going next? Where's the voice going to come from next? Was a very interesting part. And then playing with just crunching some of those guitar sounds and kind of making them bitty and crunchy, and then opening them up to sonically, like filling your ear, as you said. It was very narrow, but I was like, okay, so we've got this distant, crunchy, you know, guitar, electric guitar, but now I want it to be like almost as if you're floating in the air, and it's very bright and reverby, and it opens up and like literally opens up your kind of opens up your soul initially, and that was my intention, and it felt really good, and I think it pulled off very well.
Yeah, I think it does exactly what you described, the crunchy sort of, I mean, at the beginning, did you use a lot of EQ to make it sound so like small?
I believe I ran it through a bit crusher. Is that what I ran it through?
That makes sense.
To pretty much make it sound as small and distant as possible. And then just kind of let that off as the song built and did it in real time. So just doing it real time, letting it off and recorded it that way. And then until it was open to like the full sound that we're used to hearing in a, you know, in a live setting. So.
Yeah. And did you use some percussive sounds on the guitar that did you pitch shift them later?
I didn't actually. I don't think I did. I don't remember.
this was a long time ago. Yeah,
it was a long time ago, and I should have looked at the project again.
Well, I really loved those percussive sounds on the guitar, so it was amazing that you were able to make them very pitchy. So that's what I thought you might have done, but you could have done it another way too.
Yeah, there was an amazing artist you had us look at who was playing with, you know, just the texture of the string sounds. I don't know if you remember, and that was something that kind of stuck with me. It was like, you know, rubbing my pick across the actual coils of the string and working with some of those sounds. So I put, you know, that in there as well. And I thought that was like interesting to play with. Would need another guitar to do that live, obviously, just to have that part, like kind of having a triangle in your band. But that was an interesting thing to think about, is how can I actually play the guitar differently in a sort of an electric space and use, you know, the body of the guitar and some of the strings to make these different sounds.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the audience wants to hear it. So let's now listen to Sandra's remix of Smells Like Teen Spirit. So Sandra, one new thing that I learned about you when I was preparing for this podcast is that you got deep into neuroscience during your studies at Columbia. I'm also really interested in musical perception and memory when I compose, and I'm always thinking about the perceptual thresholds of what the listener's brain can process and how the brain will categorize musical ideas into formal structures. So how has your study of neuroscience influenced the way you compose or produce or listen to music?
So when I decided to go to Columbia, my biggest thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to create music that provoked empathy. And thinking about that on a biological level, like what is it, what is the makeup that actually, you know, provokes empathy? Why is someone empathetic? What is happening there on a biological level? And for me, I knew nothing about it before going to Columbia, other than I know we have emotions and I know some could be, you know, the term they use, hormonal, anyone could be this and trying to figure out what is actually happening. I also know that when I listen to, you know, various different songs that I an emotion arises, something happens. And whether that's triggered by, you know, memory, hearing that song in a certain instance and remind you of, you know, being a kid somewhere or being with your family. That was something that I really wanted to explore. And thankfully, the head of the music department at the time, Brad Garden, he was my advisor. We had a conversation. I was like, I really want to explore a lot of my electives in the neuroscience department because I really want to understand, you know, what is happening when someone hears a song and or hears a sound and what that does on them, does on a biological level. And one of my goals, and still one of my goals, is I want to create soundscapes. So I want, you know, someone to tell me their story and tell me where they are and really think about what sounds are happening in the area that they grew up in, as well as talk to them, you know, some direct correlations on what songs they experienced for certain things. And so thinking about perception and thinking about, it's different for everyone, but I think there is a center line where, you know, we can understand what a love song could be and kind of feel love around it. We can understand, you know, what an angry song kind of feels like and possibly get angry around it. And I think my impetus for this was, you know, thinking about all the things that are happening in the world. And I think it was a lot of like, was it at the time, like Michael Brown and all of these things were happening and just having these discussions and like, are we able to have conversations that provoke empathy where people can come to an understanding, whether they believe in it or not, but there's some sort of understanding and mutual understanding through being empathetic. And I thought that music is a key driver for that. Like when you're born, you don't have to learn how to bob your head. It just happens. Like there is no language barrier to moving to music. And that innate kind of ability is something I wanted to tap into. And also as a performer, like I find ways that I'm sort of controlling the audience with whether how sultry I sing or how loud I sing or and so on. And so exploring what that actually means on a biological level, I think was really interesting for me, especially memory. Mm-hmm. Memory is huge because we build all of these schemas and we build all of these sort of scripts that help guide us through things. And if you can tap into certain parts of memory that provoke, I keep saying provoke empathy, but that's like the core of what I'm trying to get to is that there's this, you know, understanding that we can create through music. And we can be like, I know where I was when disco happened. I know where I was when grunge happened. I know where I was when Britney came out. I know where I was when any sort of classical piece or when I heard about Beethoven the first time. There's some sort of common denominator there. And for me, I thought that was a really important thing to look into. And I enjoy looking at music in that way, for sure. And yeah.
Yeah, I'm always thinking about memory all the time when I'm composing, because I guess I want people to remember something about the beginning of the piece as it sort of continues through the rest so that they can kind of compare and see a journey of this musical material. And I wonder, do you, like, what do you do to make your music memorable or to make certain phrases or certain melodies memorable? Like, that's something that I'm working on a lot, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I found myself being super repetitive in most cases, finding a very, you know, verse, chorus, or whether it's a melody. I found myself being really repetitive. But lately, I think one thing that I remember with building, someone told me when building solos, let's say guitar solos, you want something that people can sing and they can talk, you know, can talk to. So what I'm focusing on now is like, what is the sort of dynamic in vocal articulation that is like speech, but I can still sing, that will connect to people, that sort of conversation. So that is something that I have sort of changed post, you know, taking these classes and thinking about how to connect what is familiar and common to people that they'll remember. And it's not always a repetitive Mary Had a Little Lamb, you know, it's sort of the same thing. But what really gets in the stick, and I found that this way of doing like a conversation piece where it's not repetitive as much, actually works better. Like, how would I say, you know, I don't understand. So I don't understand, you know, just like, there's just some sort of like, it's not, it's a different a way of approaching melody for me that I find actually holds more, and that I like someone like SZA, who's a hip hop like R&B artist. She's very conversational, and I feel like I'm just talking with her, so I remember this sort of conversation as a good listener, you know.
That totally makes sense. Tapping into our brains, you know, affinity for storytelling and listening to people tell stories and conversation, and like decoding the musical in the speaking voice. So mm-hmm. that totally makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So I know that at Columbia, you also took David Salzer's class, Sound, Physics, and Perception, and mm-hmm. did some work with experimental stuff. Can you tell us a bit about your project there?
Oh yeah, that was a great class. It was one of the grad classes that I took over at CMC. And one of the cool things about that class was really our final project. And I really wanted to tie in trying to figure out if what people feel is sort of the same. So at the same time, I was taking, I think, the science of psychology with Patricia Linderman. So like looking deeper into the biological ways that we experience different emotions, as well as, you know, going through the physics and the math of music and sound. I was like, let's see if what is actually a love song, if people actually interpret it and perceive it as a love song, if there's some sort of like brain activity that is, not unanimous, but sort of the same for everyone, to allow for us to interpret like, oh, that's a love song and I feel love when I hear it. So what I did was I used this software called Max that allowed me to patch different photos that I picked. And so I took a collection of photos of people trying to kiss. So I actually took a video and then turned it into separate frames. And to eventually they do kiss in the video, but I separated them, patched them to certain frequencies in the brain that someone may experience, and then put on this sort of consumer-based EEG, which is made by Muse, put that on to like, it was just a random student who was in my class. So he put on the Muse. I played a love song. I think it was something like some Beyonce love song. Actually, no, it was I Keep On Falling. I can't remember, but it was like an Alicia Keys song. Actually, it was an Alicia Keys song, a love song. And to see if that was the same. So what they did is we put it on, they closed their eyes, they listened to the song, they put on the EEG. And the goal was to see if they could get that person to kiss based on the brainwave frequencies that they were emitting. Did they kiss? No, they didn't kiss. So maybe either my math was wrong or, you know, they didn't think it was such a great love song. They didn't have the same emotion. Maybe it was one of the songs that from a breakup, who knows? But that's the interesting part, you know?
So did you compare the brainwaves of somebody listening to the song trying to do this sort of biofeedback task to somebody who was not listening to the song, or that same person when they weren't listening to the song?
That is a really great, see, that has to be next step. So right. That was the first iteration of it. And I still like want to continue, like it needs to be tested and revised to be a little more accurate and account for, you know, the various, you know, brain frequency ranges that everyone has. It's not all the same. So that is a great test and that I need to do in a control. So thanks for that, Sky.
So just to understand the experiment a little bit more, the frequencies that you were hoping to, how did the frequencies relate mm-hmm. to the pictures?
So for first pass, it was sort of random. It was taking the alpha, the beta, and you know, those delta and those different ranges and attaching them to the beginning of the pictures, like the beginning sequence of the kissing, to the middle sequence, to the two middle sequences, to, you know, the last sequence. And that was, you know, the basic start for the project and seeing where that led. And it led to them not kissing. So I think it needs to be reworked a little bit, but that was how I patched them together.
Do you think that people have any kind of conscious control over these brainwaves?
I don't think so. You know, because again, when we're thinking about like, especially with music, and we're talking about memory and different ways that like these are how we may associate with these songs by different experiences that we've had. It's hard to account for what someone, you know, may have experienced with a song. We know it's unanimous, like Whitney Houston's voice, and there's this pitch that she hits, and there's this song that, you know. But I think that, you know, it's hard to control it unless you are some sort of Jedi that mind over matter kind of can also get through a lie detector test without setting it off in a certain way. But I don't think that we can control it. I think it's kind of set by based on your, you know, first experience or the schemas that you've built around that song. And I think that's also why I don't tell you what the song is at first. And you just have to, it's first glance, your first reaction, first listen. So if I tell you before, there might be a way for you to, you know, reset yourself. And so I think that's part of it, that sort of blind study aspect at first, where you just have no idea what's going to be played. Or if that is a love song, even, it's just a song and that's it.
Yeah. Wow. What a cool experiment.
Yeah. It was a good time. I'm glad I was able to do it. Now I just need to continue it.
For this next song that we'll listen to, when I was listening to all your music, I just especially love this song. It's really uplifting, empowering song called The Change. It is part of Sandra's singer-songwriter project, Jack Lucy. And my interpretation is that it's about continual personal growth. And at about 2:50, there's this kind of abstract interlude where your vocals are chopped up into swooping wordless syllables. And it's a pretty drastic change, which I think fits the song really well. Can you tell us a bit about your process writing this song and what were you thinking with that section in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote this song, summer of 2016, right before getting into Columbia. And at that time, I was going through a change. I went out to LA and I was like, you know, I haven't played very much. I haven't recorded a lot. And I went out to LA to visit a dear friend of mine, Justin Portis. And we just sat in his, you know, living room studio. And I'm just like, I'm going to play a couple riffs and I'm just going to say whatever is on my heart, whatever is happening. And at that time I was, you know, stuck in this place of like, trying to break from systems of like my family, which we all have, like choosing what way I want to go, religion, sexuality, like all of these various things that have been weighing on me and making a decision. Like, I'm okay being who I am without this system that I grew up in. And, you know, that process of just, I rapped before I sang. Honestly, so that order, that kind of like freestyling is how I actually write. And that's my best moment. And so working with Justin was an incredible experience because it took me outside of my comfort zone with some of the, like, you'll like, you know, the piece, the part that you're talking about, like making it a little bit more choppy and electronic, at that time was, you know, something that was very different for me, but I was trusting the process and trusting my words and trusting the change. Like, you know, some of the lyrics of that song, yes, are repetitive and they kind of go through a loop, but it was more like that sort of mantra or like affirmation to myself over and over again that, you know, this change is okay. And other people are feeling that. And some of the lyrics even like are a play on like, it's the faith you call, like, who am I going to call when I'm in trouble? Like, is it my parents' God? Is it this? Is it that? Or even, you know, the lyric, like, it's the mark of self-identity. I mean, I grew up Christian and there's this whole idea of the mark of the beast. I know we're not going into religion, but like just playing off of that, like it's the mark of me. Like I am just, you know, Sandra or Jack Lucy or Sonny or whatever that is. But, you know, compositionally with, the whole makeup of the song, like I played a bunch of guitar riffs, you know, freestyled over that. And Justin and I just sort of built the production around that. And some of it was just me, you know, there's a tradition in Black Christian churches is this really like vamp and sort of just, you're kind of speaking, you're kind of singing to God, I guess, in a way that's sort of repetitive. And it's like, you know, the same melody over and over again, and you're kind of going into this sort of connection with God. And so I did a lot of just occasional sort of melodies here and there that he decided to chop up and kind of make sort of sound like these repetitive kind of cadences that were happening over and over again, which was kind of unique. It's not a song about God and not a song about religion, but that's my upbringing. So it was like, what am I changing? What am I getting rid of? What am I trusting in myself? Was kind of where that was.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear the story behind it, because I, of course, didn't really think of it as a song about God or anything, but I hear that connection with the form and the sort of singing to a higher being, even if that's kind of meta, like yourself in the future or the past.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So it was a great song to do. And to be honest, going to Columbia, I've sat on this song for a while and I still would need to release it. But, it's a great piece and I am very happy with, you know, kind of getting that out there. But I went through a change, and I think it was like letting that all go, and getting it down on paper and shipping it. And it's like, I've let this out, you know, moving on to the kind of like the next phase of my life. It was definitely came at a point in time. So.
Yeah. Well, we're really lucky that you, sort of ritualized that change in song that we can now hear.
Absolutely.
So let's listen to Jack Lucy's song, The Change.
This ball of fire.
So Sandra, you are the co-director and co-founder of the Scale Fellowship Program to promote the advancement of Black women in music, especially in Pittsburgh. Scale has just announced their first class of fellows, and they're all truly amazing artists. I encourage everyone to check out the Scale website. So I just want to know a bit more about Scale, and especially what was it like to build a program like this from the ground up, and what are some of the best ways that Scale and other organizations can support up-and-coming artists?
True. Thank you for asking about Scale. Scale is one of two of my really good friends and business partners, Baby Project. I moved back to Pittsburgh to work with my dear friends, Lee Solomon Pugliano and David Pugliano, to kind of bring, to help create a sustainable music ecosystem here. You know, I grew up in Pittsburgh. At some point, there was a very vibrant, you know, jazz community, a very vibrant music community. You know, in the early 1900s, people passed through, greats had played here. But, you know, kind of after the steel left and people stopped passing through, the music left and people, you know, left. I mean, I left for 10 years and 10 to 15 years, actually, at various times. And, when I graduated, one of the biggest things I wanted to do was I wanted to go back to Pittsburgh and figure out a way to help artists who are here and who want to be based in Pittsburgh to be able to create music and live in Pittsburgh, and bring a resource that I did not have being in Pittsburgh. And to be honest, that was something I've always wanted to do since I was about 15, whenever my school took away my first talent show. And I was like, wait a minute. This is where I speak and where I succeed, you know, like I don't have a talent show anymore. And that's a whole other story, but I'm so glad that, you know, 20 years later, we are here doing Scale. And so what Scale is a fellowship for Black women. And how this came about is, we originally started out, we're creating a rehearsal space that kind of does not exist here called Limelight Studios. And it's also going to be a co-working space that's specifically designed for creatives and musicians. But since the pandemic, you know, we had to put a hold on the brick and mortar, which it's back. So hopefully we'll have it open by the, you know, fall. But a couple of reports came out in the meantime about Pittsburgh. One in 2018, which was about the ecosystem of music here in Pittsburgh and leadership needing to be established in order to sustain and music industry professionals needing to stay and be available in Pittsburgh to help out the local scene, as well as some things, regulations and things with venues that needed to be changed. And then in 2019, an even more alarming report came out through the University of Pittsburgh that was commissioned by the Pittsburgh Equity Department that Pittsburgh is the worst city in comparable cities in the country. And I think that's between 87 cities or 83 cities for Black women to live by about every single metric. So we're talking income, we're talking about, you know, the death mortality rates and giving birth, everything. You can go to any other city as a Black woman and have a better life. And Pittsburgh for a number of years has been voted the most livable city by Forbes, but for who is the question? So we got together when a few grants became announced that we need to create a program in the interim. This is something we wanted to do in our brick and mortar space, but we need to do it now. And so we figured create a leadership program, create a network, and invest in the artists who are invested in the least, Black women. And so Scale came about, and it's an 8-month program where they meet with various art music professionals. They're meeting with also Rachel Cargill, who actually went to Columbia for a short time. And she is an activist and educator. And she is doing amazing work with unpacking and unlearning systematic racism for both, for everyone. You know, you have to unlearn it in every single way. And then we're working with Aritza Lars, who's a Grammy Award winning songwriter. She worked for Michael Jackson and a bunch of other folks. And I think bringing these resources to them is one of my biggest goals. People I've met throughout my career, like, how can I get them to know, like, this is Pittsburgh. There's something that's shining, you know, shining here. So I think that is, you know, my goal and how other organizations, you know, can support these artists. I mean, we're always still fundraising, you know, so that's always an option.
Yeah, the money.
the money is real. So, you know, we're still working towards the brick and mortar, and we're, you know, we have funds for the first year. So we're working towards getting funds for the second year, which is great. So please, you know, contact us for that. But, you know, I wanted to also just say, you know, without some of the other programs that I have had the opportunity to be a part of, especially at, you know, CMC, you know, having the kind of idea of what this program could really be kind of wouldn't be possible. Like working with Professor Ellie Hassaman and working with her for the Daughters of Harlem project that they've run for 2 years was amazing. I ran into Ellie just from being, I think Columbia had a mentor program. And I was like, I want a female music mentor. And she was there and we met. And the biggest, you know, thing that happened is I became part of this program. So the first time I just assisted and helped. And then the second year I became a workshop leader and got to work with some amazing, you know, kids, which was great. So the program itself, you know, works with young women of color throughout, you know, Harlem. And I think we also had some folks from Brooklyn and brought them to the Computer Music Center and had them really create music and really experience, you know, the entire process in, you know, a state-of-the-art facility, which was great. And it's a similar thing that we want to do with Scale.
Yeah, I will just give a shout out that everyone can go to the website for the Daughters of Harlem, and there's a SoundCloud page where you can hear some of the projects that the students produced or the participants. And I just want to know a teeny bit more about what it was like to be a mentor for that program. Because I know the participants made their pieces in a really short amount of time. So sort of how did they do that? How did you facilitate that music making?
Yeah, that was very, very quick. It was like a 2-day program and they kind of, worked. So I'm going to go back. So what they did for their work. So they came in of 1 day of actually working with about 4 to 5 different workshop leaders, and we each showed them various things. So my workshop was more about, you know, songwriting, and I brought in all of my guitars. I brought in, you know, my bass, and the students, which was amazing. They already came with either partial songs or already playing an instrument or lyrics or poetry, and they were finding ways to collaborate. So we had about five young women in each group, and they collaborated to create one song. And so I showed them, you know, basic songwriting patterns and harmonies and some of more of the kind of pop styles. And then they went on to other rooms and learned some mixing and some sort of ways of working with digital music and working with digital sound and MIDI. And at the end created a piece. So kind of like their files traveled with each workshop leader and they built off of that. What was most surprising, not surprising for me, but I had to like take a seat back and be like, these students are, there's not much I need to teach them. I'm just here to support them and what they already know and what they want to do. That's really what this program was about. And building confidence in them and encouraging them, like what you want to bring to the table is important. It does matter. And we want to hear it. So how do you want to tell us it? How do you want to participate in this? How do you want to engage with us? And it wasn't about like, so I've done it this way for the number of 20 years, and this is how it should be done. And they came with so much knowledge and creativity. And wanting and yearning, even if they didn't know how to play an instrument, to learn a part and do something that I thought was amazing. And that's kind of what it means to have access to these things, to be able to explore what you want to do and have options. I think that was the biggest thing of that program, was providing access and options to figure out, I do want to do this, or I don't, or I trust myself, you know.
Yeah, I think that's such a great philosophy, and that's really what I've found working with youth too, and any composition student or music student, is they usually come to the table with just full of ideas and gifts, and you just want to empower them to get it out there.
Yeah, those tools are very essential. Just been like, they're like, I want to do this. Great, here's a tool that I've used that can help you do that, but let's see if it works, you know.
Exactly. So going back to the Scale Fellowship, you mentioned that, you know, you have some grants and you have funding for the first year. just from a logistical perspective, I know that, of course, having enough money to do something bold like this is one of the biggest barriers and challenges. So how do you raise money and sustain this project?
Absolutely. So one thing that's great about Pittsburgh is they do have, I think it's 12 to 15 arts foundations or foundations that are really dedicated to, supporting arts, individual organizations as well. And then a few grants came about. There's one that's been around for, I guess, the last 10 years or so, or a little less, called Advancing Black Arts. And it's a combination of the Heinz Endowment and I believe the Pittsburgh Foundation. And they really focus on ways for you to advance Black arts, whether it's as an individual or as an organization. And whether it's operating funds or for a particular project and so, and you've kind of have this opportunity to apply for those. And then recently, you know, post pandemic and post all of the, things that are going on in regards to Black Lives Matter, there's the Arts and Equity Reimagined Fund. That was about 12 different organizations that came together to help, build equity when it comes to actually giving grants, because that's also an issue. And so received one of those grants as well. And then, working with organizations and other companies, we're intentionally going to folks who have made an intentional effort to, build equity within their company and to address it. And I think that's what we're looking for now, and we're continuing to look for, are those folks and those companies. It doesn't matter really what it is. It could be Xerox to, Fender, if we want to be very specific to music. But if you haven't made an effort and you haven't been thinking about and you haven't had a conversation about what equity looks like or trying to become more equitable in your practices, it's hard for us to say like this is going to be part of it, but that's what, that's what we're looking for. And there are plenty of companies who are out there doing that. And we hope that you find us soon and, can go to limelightpgh.com and, support Scale for the next couple of years.
Yes, thank you for sharing that with our audience. So can you give us the website one more time for Scale?
Absolutely. It's limelightpgh.com. And so right there, you'll find the Scale. Just click on Scale Fellowship and you'll get all the information about our 8 fellows who are amazing musicians and artists who have plenty of music on Spotify, and they're really great. As well as, more about the program and ways to sponsor and get involved. And even if you want to be a facilitator and help and you want to offer some resources or insight to help support and advance, advancement of Black women in music would be great as well.
Yeah, I started listening to all their songs on Spotify and I was just like so happy to find this treasure trove of new music. So I definitely recommend everyone do that. And I just wish you such great success with opening up your brick and mortar space, because I know that having like a co-working space and a recording studio will be just so great for the ecosystem of Pittsburgh.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I just want to say thank you so much, Sandra, and everyone in the audience. This has been Sandra E. Woodruff II, and thank you for this wonderful conversation and for sharing your amazing work with us.
Thank you so much, Sky, for having me. It's great to see you again. I wish I could take another class with you.
Me too. Yeah. I wish I could take a class with you.
Uh-oh. We'll see. Maybe I'll do a Zoom class.
Yeah, I would do songwriting with Sandra.
No, that sounds good. That sounds good. Thank you so much.
Unsung Stories, Women at Columbia's Computer Music Center, is a 3-pronged event, a podcast series, a symposium, and a concert that focuses on the history of composers of marginalized identities, including women composers of color, who have undertaken significant creative work in electronic and computer music. The project's objectives are to spotlight the little-known work of many of the women who studied and worked at the CMC since 1951, to explore collectively how institutional networks and intersections of race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and other identifications impacted and continue to impact the daily work and visibility of women composers, and to examine how systemic racism, as it intersects with gender and sexuality, can be combated in the field of electronic music, one that is still largely dominated by white men. For more information, please visit unsungstoriescmc.com.
This podcast was produced by Zasha DeCastri, Ellie Hisama, and Paolo Cosermelli Messina, with editing by David Adamczyk.
Our theme song was composed by DMR. You can learn more about her music and work at dmr.land. This project is made possible by the generous support of a public outreach grant from the Center for Science and Society at Columbia University.